Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, go to the events page and get one of the, you know, the remaining tickets for the Northwest Arkansas Regional Conference. That here we still stand, Regional Conference. First weekend of May, still a handful of tickets left. Go grab them while you can and come hang out with Chad, myself, and a whole bunch of other people while we're talking about grace and peace in Christ. You wouldn't want to miss that. It's going to be a good time. You can get a link in the show notes or go to the events page and find the Here We Still Stand regional event. We finished up last episode. We finished up Job 6, which means we ended sort of halfway through Job's response to his first friend. We got halfway through that. So he has a two-chapter response. It's a lengthy response. Chapter 7 is appropriately titled, Job Continues, My Life Has No Hope. So this is an appropriate heading because he indeed is continuing. And he, of course, is going to tell you that hope is in low supply for him right now.
Yeah, he's had it pretty rough. He's going to spend these first few verses, well, more than just a few, a lot of the verses just basically using poetic speech to describe how bad he has it. I mean, just how terrible his life is at the moment.
Yeah. And he begins who can blame him, right? I mean, no lie detected.
Yeah. No one can say, "Oh, Job, I think you're exaggerating."
Yeah, you're kind of overreacting there, Job, aren't you?
Yeah, this is like this is true speech. If there's anyone who has a right to lament and complain, it's definitely Job. And he starts out by talking about life here as like basically slave labor, just a hard job in which you're always looking for a break and you never seem to get one. Has not man a hard service on earth, and are not his days like the days of a hired hand? And by that, days of a hired hand, I don't think that Job means, you know, clock in at 9, clock out at 5.
He ain't talking about 9 to 5 at the bank.
This isn't 9 to 5 in a nice air conditioned building with your cubicle. This is rough work out in the field.
It's kind of how we feel, right, Chad, when we like sit down and record this podcast. We're like, gosh. Is it not hard for us hired hands out here? Hired hand is has this connotation. I listen to a lot of Old West podcasts, Chad, you know, and a hired hand is the thing you do when you can't do anything else, right? Like, so, like, you're not, like, looking. Like, your life goal is not to be what is described as a hired hand. This isn't, like, what you dreamed of as a kid. Like, maybe I could go to a ranch or a farm. This is more like a prodigal son coming home and telling his dad, give me whatever work you got. So the hired hand just does whatever he's told to do. I'll do the worst thing. What do you mean to clean the pigsties out? That's what I'll do. You need me to whatever it is. So it's all grunt work. It's the connotation of hired hand is certainly that of doing the worst thing for a little.
Yeah, this is to bring you back memories of my teenage and college years. Yeah. I mean, I had a great job, worked at a feed store in Sherman, Texas, but that meant, like, you know, the truck pulls up and you've got thousands of bags to unload or salt blocks to unload. And then you get in college and I worked on the roof. I was a roofer for several summers, which is by far the hardest work that I've ever done. So that's what he's talking about here. This is hard service. This is the days of a hired hand.
Well, he also uses the word, you know, slave. He's like a slave who longs for the shadow and like a hired hand who looks for his wages. In his mind, a hired hand and a slaver, there's not a lot of daylight between those two things.
Yeah, distinction without a difference, really.
Yeah.
Like, I really like the image of a slave who longs for the shadow because it doesn't say he actually gets the shadow. It's like he's out in the sun, he's sweating, he's worn out, and he wishes that he could go sit in the shade. Or he wishes a cloud would hide the sun and he never gets it.
Yeah.
He just keep on working, keep on laboring, keep on sweating. And says, so he says all of that in the first two verses. And then he says, so in an analogous way, so I am allotted months of emptiness and nights of misery are apportioned to me. A lot of this sounds like, by the way, the musings of Koheleth, the preacher in Ecclesiastes. vanity of vanities, all this vanity, this idea of emptiness and chasing after the wind, and the seeming futility of human existence, where no matter what you do, I mean, Solomon, of course, is writing from a very different perspective. He had led of course, a spoiled life in which he pursued pleasure and whatnot, but never was, you know, engaged in hard service or slave labor. But still, you kind of have the same perspective. It's empty. It's vain. It's just kind of a vaporous existence. And he starts in the second half of verse 3 to talk about something that actually comes up quite a bit. Over the weekend, I was in Birmingham speaking at the Advent down there. Great group of folks. And one night I was at a get-together, and one of the fellows and I were talking about the Psalms. And he said, you know, the older I get, the more I notice, I guess because I can connect with it, I notice how often the psalm is up at night. Yeah. So we're kind of bemoaning the fact that the older we get, the more we wake up at night. Not even, you know, not because you have to run to the restroom, just because you just wake up, you know. And I said, yeah, because many, many times the psalmist is, his eyelids are held open by God, or he's tossing, or he's turning, you know, he can't get to rest. And that's what Job is describing, nights of misery. Verse 4 says, when I lie down, I say, when shall I arise? But the night is long, and I'm full of tossing till the dawn. So, you know, you might look for, you're like, oh, fine, I can go to bed. I can rest. I can just kind of catch up on my sleep and be refreshed in the morning. And it turns out, no, the night's just as bad as the day, if not worse, because you expect to sleep, you expect to rest, but instead you toss and you turn. And we all know how miserable that can be. That's kind of where Job's at. And of course, part of this is because what it describes in verse 5, this is gross stuff, but this is an apt description of what Job is going through. My flesh is clothed with worms and dirt. I mean, just imagine that imagery.
Clothed worms.
What are you wearing? Worms and dirt. It's my shirt, my pants, my shoes. That's what I'm wearing. I'm clothed with worms and dirt. My skin hardens and then breaks out afresh. So it just, you know, kind of a scabby, and then it's oozing, and it's just nasty all over, which is, you know, exactly what we've heard Job described as. He's covered head to toe in these sores, and he's scratching them, scraping them with a potsherd. So just a terrible, terrible existence. So no surprise I couldn't sleep.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you sleep when you're feeling that way? You know, no matter where you lie down, it hurts. And then he kind of switches the image here to describe the how fast life, it just seems to go, and you wake up and one day it's over. And he uses the image of a weaver's shuttle. So Dan, do you know what a weaver's shuttle is? Because I had no idea.
It's like it's like a bus that weavers take to the weavery.
That's the best definition I've ever heard. So I was like, this has been a couple weeks ago. I was like, what in the world is a weaver's shuttle? So I actually had to YouTube this. I was like, oh, okay, that's what a weaver's shuttle is. So you're sitting at the, you know, the whatever it's called where you weave, and you got these threads that are, say you're sitting in front of it. Well, they're stretched out vertically in front of you, but you got to get the horizontal threads through there too. That's what you're weaving. Of course, you're weaving the vertical with the horizontal. And the weaver's shuttle is a tool that you use to kind of move that thread horizontally back and forth, left, right, right, left. So there you go. And evidently, this is really fast. So my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle. There's a couple of places in the Old Testament where this analogy is used. And this swift passing of the days, like a weaver's shuttle, they come to an end without hope. And thus, the way the ESV has titled this section, My Life Has No Hope. So that's uplifting.
Yeah, that's great.
I feel much better now that we've covered those six verses. But, you know, this is the way it works. When there's no glamorizing of suffering, there's no trying to you know, just kind of tone it down a little bit and focus on the positive. Job is just being very blunt. This is the way it is. This is what I'm going through. This is what I look like. This is what my days and my nights are like. And then he shifts in verse 7. He shifts in such a way that I believe this is kind of where you have him. If he hasn't been praying indirectly already, then he's going to really focus on directing these next words to God. Remember that my life is a breath. Ruach is the Hebrew there, which is breath or wind or spirit. Probably breath is a good translation here. My life is a breath. You breathe in, you breathe out, it's over. My eye will never again see good. The eye of him who sees me will behold me no more. So it's like God is looking at him, but he won't be for long because he's going to pass away and he will be no more. While your eyes are on me, he says, I'll be gone. As the cloud fades and vanishes, so he who goes down to Sheol does not come up. He returns no more to his house, nor does his place know him anymore. That's a pretty common image in the Psalms where when you go down to the place of death, which is what Sheol is in the Old Testament, when you go down to the place of death, that's it. There's no coming up again. So it's over and over in the Psalms, you have Sheol or the place of death described as the place from which there is no return. And this doesn't mean that there's a denial of the resurrection. It's just the way in which death is described, where there you go, you're going down and you're not rising up again. So it becomes an image of finality. So once it's over, it's over.
Yeah, in the Old Testament, it's not as though, you know, there are allusions, of course. David makes these allusions. We're going to have Job straight up make one of the great sort of confessions eventually, right? There's an acknowledgement of being with God, or that there's something else, right? What the Old Testament doesn't have sort of explicitly, at least I don't think, is, and this is something that is so great about Christ, is that it doesn't give you like this explicit, like, it's not hinted at by God, but that the people, the believers in God, don't have this explicit theology of like the resurrection of the body. Like this is saved for Christ. Like Christ is the one who reveals exactly what this is all going to look like.
Yeah, it's pretty meager. I mean, you have some passages in Isaiah. Daniel is probably the clearest indication of this. Talks about those who rise. But it's not like, oh man, it's all over the place.
Yeah.
At least not explicitly. Now, when you get to the New Testament and the resurrection of Christ, and you go back, well, you got even passages like Exodus 3, which Jesus quotes. I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He's not the God of the dead, but of the living.
Yep.
But not many people say in Joshua's day or even David's day would have read Exodus 3, that verse, and thought, oh, obviously.
That means I'm going to be risen bodily on the last day. That's not how they interpreted that stuff.
So you kind of need God himself to come in the flesh and say, hey, you know what this means?
Well, this
it
is,
means that there's a resurrection.
Yeah, this is like, you know, Peter will say, you know, that, hey, even like the prophets and stuff, a lot of times they're writing stuff and then they're studying what they wrote. Like God's giving them a word, but I mean, they don't know exactly what this means. You know, I mean, Isaiah, when he's writing, does he really understand in detail exactly what he's talking about? Like, I think Peter would say, no, he doesn't. Like he doesn't understand as he's writing about the suffering servant and stuff. Isaiah does not have like the crucifixion in his mind. Like this is not how this works.
Not like he's got, you know, his writings here. He's got the Nicene Creed on the other side. He's like, oh yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Or a magic mirror, and he's looking down the corridor of time, and he can see how this is going to play out or something. It's just, this is the word that God has given him. And then once you have the cross, then you look back and you're like, well, this all makes sense. And once you have the resurrection, certainly, I mean, we're going to get to Job doing this exact thing. Like there's Job's going to make a confession that only makes sense in the resurrection of Christ.
Yes. Yeah. But did Job fully understand it, or Isaiah, or whoever? No. No, yeah. That's just not the way that that's not the way the Old Testament worked. The way I like to, this is not my own analogy, but others have used this. It's the idea, like, say you're walking along a dirt road, landscape is flat, and you see something in the distance, and you don't really know what it is. I mean, is it an animal? Is it a person? Is it something else? You know, something is there, but you can't quite make it out. And then you get a little bit closer, you're like, oh, I'm pretty sure that, yeah, that's a person. It's not an animal, but you can't tell if it's a man or a woman. And you go a bit closer, you're like, oh, that's okay. It's a man. I can tell now, but I can't tell if he's 20 or if he's 50. So it's kind of like that as you work your way through the Old Testament. The farther along you get, the greater clarity, the greater precision that you get. But that being said, even when you get to the Gospels themselves, of course, and you have these guys who have traveled for 3 years sitting at the feet of Jesus, they're still not really fully getting it. The resurrection has to happen. Pentecost has to happen before all of a sudden the veil is lifted and there is clarity and precision.
And the death and resurrection of Christ is like finding out that Bruce Willis was dead the whole time in The Sixth Sense, and all of a sudden the entire last 90 minutes that you spent watching this movie make complete sense.
Yeah. And then you go back to Genesis and you rewatch the whole Bible movie. Like, yes. Oh.
Yes. This is correct.
Yes. How did I not see that the entire time?
Yes.
I use that movie all the time as an example of that. Because, I mean, it is. You feel kind of dumb, actually.
Yeah.
When you get to the end of it and you realize, you're like, oh.
This wasn't even that hidden. That. It was right there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he gets shot at the beginning, right? Yeah. It's like, how did you not see this?
Sorry if we spoiled that movie. I mean, it's been out for like 25 years, so at this point, if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, I don't know what to. That's I'm your sorry. Fault. That's right. It's not on us. So anyway, so that's verse 10. He ends up, you know, in Sheol, doesn't return. Therefore, verse 11, he says, because of this, I'm not going to shut up. I'm not going to restrain my mouth. I'm going to speak in the anguish of my spirit. I'm going to complain in the bitterness of my soul. And he certainly does that, as he should. That is the boldness of the sufferer in the scriptures, rather than simply having kind of a stoic acceptance of how bad life is and just, you know, dealing with it. There's a protest. There's a prayerful protest that sufferers in the scriptures will always go to, rather than simply saying, well, forget it. You know, life is bad. Nothing's going to change it. They cry out to God. That's what he says here. I'm not going to shut up. I'm going to keep crying out in the anguish of my spirit.
Part of this is also, I mean, the therefore here is based on what him saying, my life is a breath. Here very shortly, I mean, how long can I live like this? I mean, my days are surely numbered. The day is coming very soon where people who are looking at me now, they will look and not see me. Like, I will be gone. Therefore, I'm not going to restrain my mouth. I'm going to speak of the anguish of my spirit. Why? Because this might be the last day, and I will be heard. My days are very limited. They're a mere breath. And so, since that is the case, these are the words that I'm going to say.
Yeah, I'm going to take advantage of the time that I have. Verse 12, am I the sea or a sea monster that you set a guard over me? Not quite sure what to do with that. Some people actually will personify this as, am I Yom, which is the Hebrew word for sea, which is personified in a lot of ancient Near Eastern texts. Or my Tanin, that's the Hebrew behind sea monster. Tanin occurs, it's kind of like a leviathan. Tanin is, it's one of these almost mythological creatures. So am I the sea, am I sea monster that you set a guard over me? When I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint. So when he says, hey, I'm just going to get some rest. I'm going to go to bed, or I'm going to lay down on the couch. Then, verse 14, you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions. So much so. So again, this is kind of getting back to the whole nighttime. In here, it's not as if he can't sleep. Is when he does go to sleep, he has these terrible dreams, nightmares. In fact, so bad, he says, that I would choose strangling and death rather than my bones. That is, rather than my existence. Some translations are written to this, that my throat would choose strangling. And the reason they do that is because the I would choose strangling, in Hebrew is nefesh. Nefesh can mean soul or spirit. It can just be a way of referring to a person or to yourself. But it can also be, in some context, nefesh means throat. Like literally, physically, your throat. Which fits actually here, so that my throat would choose strangling. Of course, it is your throat that is strangled. So I would choose strangling and death rather than my bones. That is, rather than kind of continuing to exist. Why? Because he says, I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Leave me alone. This is him talking to God. Leave me alone, for my days are a breath. This is, I think Psalm 34 uses that same expression where, Psalm 39 rather, where he says, look away from me that I may smile again before I depart and am no more. So it's one of these kind of strange seeming contradictions where he's crying out to God. He's saying, I'm not going to shut up. I'm going to keep crying out. But at the same time, he's like, God, just leave me alone. Go away. He doesn't know what he wants, which I think a lot of us can appreciate that. Like we're crying to God. And at the same time, we're like, just leave me alone. We want our space, but we also want to be heard.
Well, there seems to be a acknowledgement here that that it is God who sustains life, and certainly his life. I mean, he's got to be thinking, how am I not dead yet? Like, what is going on? Well, it seems like I should be dead. And in fact, I wish I were. I loathe my life. I would not live forever. That doesn't mean, that just means that I don't want to live forever. That's what this means, right? So I would not live forever is I'm not looking to prolong my life here. So since that's the case, I would like you to leave me alone, for my days are a breath. So if you could just abandon me, maybe I could die. This is what's going on here. Unfortunately for Job, he's going to have to live forever. Sorry. That's just the way it is. But he doesn't want it right now. And so, it's a weird thing for, and I think, I mean, I've known people who are very old and suffering a lot, who are like, not in this situation, but would be happy for God to, I know that my days are numbered. It would be fine with me if that number was now. Like I'm ready to go. Right. Job is in an extreme case of that, where he's saying, maybe you should turn your back on me so I can die already.
Yeah, I've known a number of situations, especially with people who are elderly. They're like, listen, maybe their spouse has died. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of their friends. And they're like, why am I still here? You know, yeah. Or maybe they're suffering from whatever it might be. And they're like, this, I'm really tired. I'm tired of fighting this. I just want to go to be with Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. any day would be good, God, any day.
Yeah. You know, what was interesting about this, too, is that you're right that Job's confused, because on one hand, he's like, you've abandoned me. And then on the other hand, he's like, would you please turn your back on me so I can die?
Yeah, right. Well, I think this is the life of the sufferer. You know, on the one hand, you're angry at God or you're confused about what he's doing. On the other hand, you want him to be with you and to help you. And your life is confusing, your mind is confused, and you're confused about God. And so you shouldn't expect any kind of, you know, rational prayers that are taking place. It's quite in keeping with the situation that you're in, that you're all over the place, you know, come and help me, God, leave me alone, you know, be with me, walk away.
Yeah.
Smile on me. Don't smile at me. All that kind of back and forth.
Well, what Job's struggling with here is he, in his mind, God has so abandoned him that he's keeping him alive. which is a very strange place to be, right? Like, you're so opposed to me that you won't let me die. This is like the worst of all possible scenarios in Job's mind, right? Like, yeah, in other words, I don't believe that you're obviously not helping me, but also you're also not completely removed from me, which is the worst case scenario.
Yes. Yeah. You've locked me up in this cage where I can't die, but you won't come see me.
Yes.
Give me anything that I need.
Yep.
Now, verse 17 is interesting because this sounds exactly like a parody of Psalm 8, which we recorded last week.
Yeah. That is out.
So, Psalm 8 is this great, first of all, you know, humble question. You know, what is man that thou art mindful of him, the son of man that you think of him? Yet, you know, you made him for a little while lower than the angels and crowned him with glory and majesty. So this whole, you know, what is man? We seem so small, but you've just given us this grandeur and this glory, which of course culminates in Christ. So you got that. But then listen to this, verse 17. What is man that you make so much of him and that you set your heart on him? Visit him every morning and test him every moment. So it's, you begin by thinking, oh, he's maybe going to kind of shift here into a psalm. What is man? But no, he's saying, like, what is it with you, God? Why do you make so much of us in the sense of testing us every morning and every moment of our lives? Would that you would just not make so much of us so that we could have a little bit of peace and tranquility in this brief life that we have. How long will you not look away from me, nor leave me alone till I swallow my spit? So here we have, you know, God's looking at him. He won't look away from him. He won't leave him alone so he can swallow his spit, whatever that means. I guess, there's, you know, he's wanting to, I don't know. I don't know what that means. Nor leave me alone till I swallow my spit. Is that just talking about what we, you know, physically, or is this a metaphor for something else? I really don't know.
Yeah, this is a wild thing to say, right? So, you know, David, of course, is like, hey, man, why is man such a big deal to you? That you've, you know, that you've given him all these wonderful things. And Job is like, why is man such a big deal to you that you won't just let him die?
That's it. I mean, it's a parody on Psalm 8 with very, very different outcomes. Now, verse 20, we're at the end of this chapter, verse 20, 21. So ESV, and I'm not sure about other translations. I'll check it while we're talking here. But ESV has an if at the beginning of this. If I sin, what do I do to you, you watcher of mankind? And so that's ESV. New American Standard has, have I sinned? King James has, I have sinned. What shall I do unto you? Now, the reason you have all these various kinds of translations is because there is no if in the Hebrew. So ESV has added that because they think it makes sense here. Other translations don't have it there. I think it probably makes more sense just to take it out. For Job is saying, yeah, I'm a sinner. I've sinned. And when I do that to you. What am I doing to you, you watcher of mankind? Kind of keeping your eye on humanity. Why have you made me your mark? Why have I become a burden to you? Why don't you just pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I shall lie in the earth. You will seek me, but I shall not be. That's what makes most sense to me in that context.
Yeah, you don't need it if I sin. If you just have I sin, this is just a confession of course I sin, and it is interesting to do this. Like, yeah, I sin, but how's it hurting you exactly? Right? You just,
yes. Yeah, has my sin in some way affected you? Well, if I sin, I suppose it's going to affect me. It's not going to affect God. So, what do I do to you, you watcher of mankind? It's like God is is guarding humanity, making us his target? Or, you know, am I a burden to God when this takes place? And the answer, of course, all these rhetorical questions is no. I'm not a burden to you. So why is my life as difficult as it is? And if there's some sin, why don't you just pardon that and take it away? But as it is, I'm about to die. And where I'm going, you can look for me, but I won't be there. No, this is more kind of the Sheol talk. You can look for me, but I won't be around because I'll be in the grave.
Yeah, I do like this sort of this part of a sort of confession of who God is, where Job is certainly acknowledging, of course, I'm a sinner, but you are acting sort of differently than I understand you to be, which is that you are treating me, in Job's mind, it feels like him, you are treating me only according to my sin. Like, so I've become your mark. This is, you have marked me out. I've become like this burdensome thing to you, but why is it then that you wouldn't just pardon my transgression to take away my iniquity? Because this is how I understand you to be for everyone else. Why are you not this for me? Why am I different?
And that's Job's basic confusion. I mean, not here, but throughout the book, like what he knows of God and what he is experiencing, there's this dissonance that is existing that he's trying to figure out. I mean, that is the struggle all through the book. Like the God I've known and the God that I am now experiencing are so different that I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah.
And it's a terrible place to be in. Obviously it is for Job, but it is for any of us, where God doesn't seem in our experience to be consistent with who he's promised to be or who he's been for us in the past. And that leads, of course, to all kinds of questions and struggles and internal deliberations and external laments and everything we're reading in the book of Job. All right, we'll shift to 8. This is the first speech of one of the other friends. This guy's name is Bildad the Shuhite. So he's been listening to Job, and he's going to jump in here. Bildad seems to me kind of a theological simpleton. I guess that's the best way that I can explain him. In Bildad's theology, the Bildadian theology, we'll call it, things are very simple. You're either good or you're bad. And if you're good, God will reward you. And if you're bad, he will punish you. So it's a very kind of very simplistic, very moralistic view of God's dealings with humanity. So he says to Job, basically, how long will you keep on just being a blabbermouth? And, you know, just how long will you say these things and the words of your mouth be a great wind? You're just talking and nothing is coming out, but just these bursts of air. There's no real substance to them, in other words. Does God pervert justice? Or does the Almighty pervert the right? Now, verse 4, talk about a low blow here. Verse 4, if your children, Job's children, if your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. In other words, Job, I want to be the bearer of bad news to you, but your children got what they had coming. Yeah. All your children who died, they must have sinned against God, and he delivered them into the hand of their transgression. So learn from their example, Job. This is what happens to sinners. They got together, they sinned, God killed them. That's more or less what he's saying. So you can understand from Job's perspective why these friends are such miserable comforters.
Yes.
Imagine showing up at somebody's house and saying, your child died or your children died, but you know, this is what happens when you're a sinner.
People do this kind of stuff too, like this sort of, does God pervert justice or does the Almighty pervert the right? This is what happens when somebody is suffering. A theologian shows up instead of a pastor and just says, well, I hear the things you're saying. Let me ask you this. Sounds like you're saying that God has perverted justice, or that the Almighty doesn't always do what's right. Maybe you should check your theology, Job. This is not helpful.
Not helpful. No, no. This is this is the Pharisaical approach, where if you're good, you're blessed. But, you know, if something happens to you, evidently you're bad. You kind of reason backwards, right? Oh, so a terrible thing happened to you or somebody else. Well, then let's kind of walk backwards. A terrible thing happened. That must have been because you did a terrible thing. And therefore, the terrible thing you're experiencing is God getting his pound of flesh for what you've done. Or in this case, Job's kids.
Yeah. Or, I mean, this is the kind of friend I feel like if he went and explored the Psalms a little bit, he'd be like, "This David's a terrible theologian. It sounds like he questions the goodness of God sometimes. It sounds like he questions if God is in the right sometimes. It sounds like he doesn't have complete trust in what God is doing." So I'm going to, in the midst of his suffering and frustration, I'm going to go correct his theology.
Yeah. And unfortunately, Bildads are still among us. Not great comforters.
No.
So he, verse 5, he's saying to Job, learn from the mistakes of your children. And what you need to do, if you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, you know, if you become pure and upright. There is no verb in the Hebrew here. Kind of supply the verb. And it could be are, or it could be become. So if you are, if you become pure and upright, well, then God is going to rouse himself. He's going to literally get out of bed. He's going to wake up for you and restore your rightful habitation. I tell you what, Job, even though your beginning was small, then your latter days will be very great. He makes it sound like it's so easy.
Yeah.
You know, to learn from what's happened to these other sinners and just turn to God, plead with the Almighty. If you become pure and upright, well, then God is going to reward you. In fact, he's going to make your latter days better than your former days.
Hey, repent harder, Job.
Repent harder, more sincerely.
Yeah.
Then finally, God will do these great things for you.
This is a great thing to show me. Job, have you sought God in any of this, though? It's bizarre. Just bizarre. Well, you haven't sought him the way that you need to seek him, don't you understand? Like, I mean, I'm listening to your words, Job, and these are not the words that you should use. Like, different words, Job. And if you use the right words, then, of course, God is going to love that string of words. They're going to enter his ear, and they're going to stir up his heart, and he's going to rise up for you, Job, of course. But these are not the words to use. You're using all the wrong words. You have to use some pure and upright words. Yeah, dude, not helpful.
Really impress God with your purity and sanctity. He's going to do great things for you. He's almost kind of a name it and claim it theologian. At least he's bordering on that for sure.
Yeah.
So verses 8 through 10, and we'll probably wrap up with this. Basically, he says, we don't live long. We're here yesterday, we're gone tomorrow. And so we need to just think about the wisdom of the past and learn from it. He says, inquire, please, of bygone ages. Consider what the fathers have searched out. We are but of yesterday. We know nothing. Our days on earth, well, they're just basically a shadow. Will they, that is these people of bygone ages, will they not teach you and tell you and utter words out of their understanding? Now, this is a great example of where, and we see this so many times in Job, where certain things are said by the friends of Job, which is, you know, on the surface, there's some truth in them. Should we study the past? Should we learn from, should we stand on the shoulders of giants? I think that's the CS image. Of course, I mean, we're all learning from people who've gone before us, and our lives are limited, so there's only so much we can learn, so we learn from others. So on the surface, it's great. I mean, that's true. We all should learn from the past. But the implication here in this context, and Bildad speaking, is that Job, you know, you just need to study the past a little bit more, and then you'll figure out that sin has consequences, And your children were sinners. They suffer the consequences. And if you don't want to suffer the consequences, if you want to get out of this terrible situation which you find yourself, and then you just need to pray more fervently and God will reward you in the end. You study history. It's worked out that way time and time again.
Dude, this is how the words that can be true, but you can only see, these are the words of like a non-sufferer, right? So like these are the words of somebody. Do you only say these words if you feel like, well, I feel like God is pretty pleased with me right now. So I feel confident in giving you these words. And that's a wild place to be, like where you'd be so confident to say, let me tell you the secret, Jim. You got to read some history. And then, you know, you just implement what you learned there. That's what I do, after all. And I'm not sitting on an ash heap covered in boils. So do that.
Real simple solution.
Yeah.
Yeah. Non-suffer, non-empathetic non-sufferers come up with these simple solutions. If you do A, B will result. And the sufferer is just sitting there shaking his head or her head thinking, you have no idea, do you?
Yeah.
But we're not finished with Bildad yet. He's got a few more things to say. He's got this long analogy that he wants to tell Job. And so we'll finish that up in our next episode.
All right, Chad. I will see you next week.
See you then.